So the theme for the talk tonight is recognizing freedom. Why are we here? What is the real reason, if you will, why we're here? Why did we come together for these 5 days? I would suggest to you that we came together to recognize freedom. And I would add to that that this is what all human beings are seeking, if they're seeking anything at all. If your or my right to say what I want to say was taken away, I would probably feel compelled to attempt to reacquire my freedom of speech. If you look closely at what human beings are doing all over the world, and you examine it deeply, what is moving in human beings to do what they do? And I think you might come up with many different sort of ideas or conclusions. But I would suggest to you, if you track them all down, what human beings are looking for is freedom. It's interesting to notice that things have probably not gone the way you planned for this retreat, if you had any plans at all. If you came with any expectations, you may have noted they've been blown out of the water. Which, if you had expectations and they've been blown out of the water, consider yourself very fortunate. Because if your happiness is connected to generating expectations, and then some of the time getting something close to what you expect, if that's your happiness, notice the fragility of that, the uncertainty of that. And most of us have a very clear sense, we have a very intuitive gut sense of what it's like to generate expectations and have them not met. Greater the expectation, greater the disappointment. Two of the folks in my immediate family, my nuclear family, I won't name them, have the tendency to generate expectations, particularly related to vacations. Now, you may have noted in life, many people, when they go on vacation, that's when some of the worst stuff happens. It's supposed to be a vacation, we have time off, and this material arises. Emotional, mental, physical, impulse, compulse. And sometimes it boils down to somebody had an expectation and it's not quite going that way. A little expectation. Maybe I was wrong. A little expectation sometimes generates a gigantic disappointment when it's not met. So, we're all together in that if you had expectations or plans for what was going to happen here, it's pretty clear that that hasn't occurred. And that connects to to that if you've had specific expectations or plans for your life, have you noticed how often those don't occur? And the reason is because life, not your expectations, is in charge. Life is living itself, and that becomes so intimately clear in the meditation. Life is happening the way it's happening. Now, there's a rare exception to what I'm saying in these kinds of activities of residential retreat, event, meditation, intensive. Every now and then somebody comes along and things are actually working out better than they expected. So they came in with an expectation, I'm going to get concentrated, I'm going to get still, I'm going to get peaceful, I'm going to get quiet, I'm going to sleep like a log, right? I'm going to do every single meditation just right, I'm going to eat like the Buddha, I'm going to eat just the right amount of food. They got it all planned out. And then something actually happens that's far better than any of that. And they go, whoa. But same principles at work. It didn't go the way you expected. It didn't go the way you planned. It blew it right out the other end. Now recognize what I'm speaking about is that it's completely predicated on preference. This is a better experience, this is a worse experience. This is a desirable experience, this is a less desirable experience. This is good for me, this isn't good for me. And on that goes until that's recognized. Oh, look at that, there's a filter. That's called a filter. Preference is a filter. So when we're sitting here, and to some extent hearing in different ways, because I'm really saying the same thing over and over in different words, because I can't say the same thing over and over in the same words. At least I'm not courageous enough to try that. I'm not sure it'd be very interesting either. Some of you might find that the Dharma talks, as long as they don't go on too long, are some of the most enjoyable moments in the retreat, because you get to forget about your meditation in a way. You get to forget about what's on the inside. And if this is any good, it's a little bit entertaining. It's different. You get to sort of sit in a chair if you felt like you need to be on a cushion. So you go up on a chair and you sit back, cross your legs. You know, every now and then you sort of go back. Like what I used to do was, it was so intense in here that I just longed for the talk. Because in the talk, I got to pay attention to something other than myself. And so in the retreats that I originally did, you know, you weren't supposed to go back at all, really, not even kind of like this, right? And you certainly weren't supposed to point your feet. So, you know, I'm listening to the talk, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm just feeling a little bit, like, more relaxed and just kind of easing back like this, and the legs wanting to sort of go out. And all of a sudden, one of the managers, there's like six managers at this course, you know, a bunch of teachers and six managers. You need that many people governing 120, you know, human beings who are getting free. And so this hand appears behind my back. It was like huge, and it was like firm, and it just said, "Don't you dare!" But I thought I was easing towards freedom. So you might ask yourself, is this random, what's going on here? Is this random? And maybe even in some people's minds, worse than random, is this chaotic? Is this unfolding that nobody has any control over? Is this random? Is this chaotic? The answer is no. There are causes and conditions for everything relative. This isn't just science, this is the Dharma. Before our so-called modern science discovered that through its own means, which is basically a means called analysis. It's not a phenomenologically based exploration, which is where the spiritual traditions come from. They come from a phenomenologically, experientially based wisdom. Interestingly enough, you can actually go up into the higher centers of the brain, you actually think about things, get reflective, and there's some meditative awareness there too, and you can sort of figure out some of this stuff and have insights. As a boy, I used to look at the pictures of Einstein, and the most interesting thing was that his hair was standing on end. And he looked free, especially on that bicycle. He's riding a bicycle, and wherever it is, you know, Germany somewhere, he's riding a bicycle, and it's like some quote, you know, it's like, oh, that's it. And little Paul recognizes something there. Still looking out, though, still looking out, looking out, looking out, looking out, looking out, looking out. So is this random, chaotic? No. There are causes and conditions for everything relative. There are causes and conditions for hunger. There's causes and conditions for restlessness. We haven't talked about that much. There's causes and conditions for happiness, for sadness, for fear, for anger, for tranquility, contentment, and love. There's causes and conditions for this building. We heard a little bit about that on Wednesday morning. What gave rise to this place? Causes and conditions for the room. Causes and conditions for this earth we're sitting on. Causes and conditions for the solar system. Causes and conditions for the solar systems. The cosmos. How about cosmoses? We can't see it all. The furthest edge of scientific truth only stays around long enough until a further edge is found. And then it eclipses the one before. And there are causes and conditions for us coming together. There are causes and conditions for meditative awareness and all that it sees. Causes and conditions for birth and death. Causes and conditions for suffering and freedom from it. You know what the cause is for death? I said it. Birth. Interest perked as to the causes and conditions for suffering? When there's clarity, when there's seeing through the causes and conditions for suffering, that's how suffering goes away. Come at it from the other angle. Thank goodness there's lots of different angles. And the angle that's most important is the angle that you find. That's what this is all about. Anybody in here finds, you could say, the right angle? Like I was suggesting in the hall this afternoon, it goes out like a ripple effect. Everybody gets something in the field effect. From any one of us, you could say, seen through. Or getting it right. It's not about getting it right versus wrong. It's about getting it correct. Seeing clearly. So you can come at it from the angle of, what are the causes and conditions for freedom? Don't need to just investigate the causes and conditions for suffering. You get the causes and conditions for freedom clear. And almost like a bonus prize, suffering falls away. No thing, meaning object, no thing, no experience exists in isolation from any other thing or experience. This is a very simple sentence that has profound significance. Not only is everything interconnected, but everything is influencing everything else. Everything is being influenced by everything else. Now, you may think, like many people, that you have free will. You think you have free will because as lunch or dinner appears, you make a big decision. Will I have hummus or not? I had it yesterday. There it is again. From the surface, it looks the same. I'm going to do something else. Those who have been drawn to the hummus, which is a mainstay here in addition to the greens, tend to have it every time it's served. Those who look more deeply tend to see different things in the hummus. I've been told I saw my face in the hummus. Your true face? Your original nature face? Or your mugshot? Should I have hummus or not? Big decision. Meditative awareness doesn't make any decisions. That's what I heard. But I need to make a decision now. Do I sit near the window and look out on the river? Someone else is doing it where I thought I'd sit. Oh, that's okay, because I feel generosity. Love and compassion's emerging for me. May you have a wonderful river meditation while I eat my hummus. It gets a little more serious than this at times. Should I sit on the floor in a chair, have my feet up a little bit or down a little bit? Where should I put my knees? I'm convinced they're probably going to start to hurt again. This friend of mine, dear friend, haven't seen him in years. When this stuff like gets into you, when you first get into this stuff, you start telling everybody. And sometimes you overwhelm them. It's like, you wouldn't believe it. It's better than hummus. It's better than... And one guy say, man, I took cocaine. I got all the way up to heroin. I took heroin, man, and I loved it. And then I started to meditate. Way beyond. Way more right than any of that substance. So I'll sit on my cushion. My cushion. What would happen? And it probably won't, but what would happen? The bell rings, you come back from your very connected walking meditation, everything's flowing, and somebody's sitting on your cushion. And you examine their face, and it appears that they did it intentionally. But then you have to reflect more deeply. Everything is interconnected, but this is an imagination that I'm projecting. This is not necessarily the truth. And I make a decision. Ah, yes, another one. I will talk to you at the end of the retreat. I will start with simple things like, my name is. And then I'll move it gradually to, what happened when you sat on my cushion? How did that occur, if you don't mind me asking? I had a teacher once who used to, he's a bit of a gadfly, and I appreciate that. And he would, he'd get like 5 days into one of these things, and he'd say, okay, when we come back in the hall, sit on any cushion that you're attracted to. And you could just feel this ripple effect go out like, it's like a cushion. And all of a sudden, you could feel it energetically. It's like, oh. And I loved it, actually. I went, great. This little boy goes, wow, any cushion I want that I can get to first? And then behind that comes, wait a minute. That big black one that I liked? That guy that I looked at his back was sitting on? I'm going to sit on his cushion? Ooh. And then the other side came, like, traction? Uh-oh. You would have been amazed at the stuff that came out of people just talking about that cushion meditation, shifting it up in the small groups. It dominated the scene. I mean, it actually sounded like in certain people's minds, it could have gone to the point where they were going to fight. Like anger, aggression, this stuff started coming up. You know, and some people were just like, you know, I bought that cushion. And they're like angry at the teacher, you know, it's just like, why did you do this? It was wild. So we won't do that. Plus, you guys are so liberated that it wouldn't matter anyway. You'd probably just come in. Steve, pinch me if I go too far off, okay? All right. Seriously. All things are being done. That's what the Christian tradition says when it says, thy will be done. Little Polly, as a child, is taught to say it over and over. Say that prayer over and over. Say that prayer over and over like a mantra. Say that prayer over and over. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm doing what I'm told. What am I talking about? I don't know. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Here's the connection. On earth, the nature of experience is unfolding freely. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Original mind, original nature, Buddha mind, free nature of mind, heaven. Heaven's not a place up there. Heaven's either right here or it's nowhere. The Dharma is the doer. The Dharma is the laws of nature. And it's what's organizing this experience. It's the truth that governs everything that's happening. So still, their strong myth is that I am the doer and I have free will. I have choice. And like I said, there's a cause and a condition for everything. The cause and the condition for the belief that you have free will and choice is delusion.
and delusion
has a cause or condition, and the cause or condition for delusion is ignorance.
Now, the belief that there is free will, I'm not saying this doesn't arise.
Yes, it does.
I'm not saying that there isn't the appearance of what many call free will. But what I'm saying is that the truth
inside what we call free will or choice is a very subtle combination of volition, which is an object of experience, volition or intention. It's the about to energy or moment before any action occurs.
It's called volition or intention. Combination of
volition or intention,
thought,
and the idea that I or me has the volition and has the thought. I am going to have some more hummus. And I'm now getting up to get it. I am going up to my room. I am opening the door. Concept of I, thought, I'm opening the door, and of course, in order for the hand to move, turn the knob, there's volition or intention.
That's actually what folks call
free will. Quite a difference, isn't it, in a way? Because when we take free will, and most of us, or some of us, have been conditioned, it's just like, get your free will really, really clear. Get it all clean, shining, polished, and moved. That's your highway. That's going to take you home. That's going to free you. Watch this.
If we had free will, then make the body stop hurting during sitting.
And while you're at it, how about make the mind quiet and have no thoughts?
If you had free will, why don't you get other people to do what you want them to do? And
while you're at it, why don't you make suffering stop?
And
while you're at that one, why don't you make liberation happen? I mean, let's just go all the way. Okay, just use free will and choice and boom, yeah, make it happen.
The reason why those who believe there's free will give for not being able to get others to do what they want is they say the other has free will too, but it's in a different direction.
Or the other one that comes up is they say, well, no, I have free will. I know how to stop the hurting of my body and this racing mind and all this stuff. Stop meditating. Got it covered, man. Met a guy recently who's in that space. He said, this is really like, I mean, you know, this is not good. This is not good what's going on here with me. I mean, I don't know about the rest of you. Kind of suggested me. I don't know the rest of you, but not for me. I know how to stop it. I'm leaving. No, you're not stopping nothing. You're running. How can anybody expect to see clearly if you run away? And it's so profound. There was a serial killer named Angulimala. Some of you know the story. It's got a lot of different parts to it, but in short, Angulimala is a serial killer. Okay, this is like a person obsessed with that. Impulse. Uncontrollable. And he's just fierce and violent, and people are frightened of him. Comes across the Buddha, and he's going to kill him. He's got it all set up. He's ready to go. Walking behind him. He's thinking to himself, you know, you can't kill somebody from the back. It's not the way to do it. You got to get eye contact. So he says, stop. Stop. Several times. Buddha doesn't stop. Finally, stop!
He stops. He turns and he says, I have stopped. In that moment, Angulimala got confused because he saw a being who wasn't afraid. Tripped him up. Plus, the Buddha gave him a koan when he said, I have stopped. He wasn't talking about physically. Angulimala got confused. And just to make the long story short, he was transformed. He began to practice the Dharma. He began to practice the meditation. He became a wonderful, radiant being of love in the same lifetime. Apparently, he killed 999 people. And the Buddha was supposed to be the 1,000th person that he was going to knock off. You can look these things up on the internet now because Google's got a lot of stuff, right? Just think of it and then go like that and something happens. Just go like this. No, do it behind your back. Something happens. Might not be what you're looking for, but something's going to pop up. This is not the exploration of compliancy. This is not the exploration of a dogma or a doctrine or a philosophy. This is not about you must do this in order to have this or that. This is about reality. This is about the truth. This is about come and see for yourself. From the very, very instant of exploration, it's about freedom. The freedom to explore, to look, to see for yourself. So the heart of the religious and spiritual traditions and practices is the investigation of the true nature of what you are. And the idea is that if you're suffering or troubled, if there's troubledness going on, there's a way out. And that's couched in different kinds of terminology and different kinds of paths and practices and whatnot. But ultimately it boils down to finding out who you really are. In some cases, the notion is that if you systematically find out what you're not, you will be moving more and more close to what you actually are. This is kind of actually partly what's going on here. And this is effective, provided the particular method or technique fits your particular proclivities, inclinations, and there's a resonance that hooks up. Because you can't make that resonance happen. You could try to make it happen, but I would suggest to you it's much, much more simple and direct. Get in touch with the sense of resonance with the truth as you perceive it, even if it feels like it's still clouded and this and that, and then see what that hooks up to in terms of what you're going to do, who you're going to spend time with, and so forth and so on, if you're going to do that. And there's a lot of value in taking time to just go deeper into that resonance completely on your own. In fact, I recommend every day some time, nothing to do, nowhere to go, no responsibility, but the opportunity to look at the nature of what's occurring. At times, the tradition will offer ways to adjust your actions and even your intentions behind your actions to improve your conditions or the conditions of others. Sometimes there'll be faith and prayer that's suggested. And at times, this faith and prayer is leveraged with obedience and austerity, tying these activities to the promise of a later reward in this life or in some place called the
hereafter. Like that word? Hereafter? Does that mean more of here after here? Interesting word. The hereafter.
Sometimes it's all about helping others. Any way you can. Service.
The word selfless service is used sometimes. Karma yoga. I've met some karma yogis who are very busy egotistically serving others with karma yoga activity. Because the ego self cannot dissolve the ego self. But the idea would be, if I serve others and I can do it selflessly, I can figure out what a bodhisattva is.
Sometimes it's all about going inside, 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 inside. Sometimes it's all about getting the body and health as fine-tuned as possible. Sometimes it's about surrender or commitment. Sometimes it's about a pilgrimage. And sometimes it's about meditation. And sometimes it's about attempting to live non-violently. That's a whole religion right there. It's called the Jain faith, Mahavira. Quite some time back, not too far after or before, don't quote me, the time of the Buddha, Mahavira, it's like, ahimsa, non-violence. That's the one to focus on. Created a whole religious faith around it. Interesting. But regardless of the style or method, its time in history, or the people who've practiced or are practicing, if it's an authentic, true practice, it's always about finding out who you really are. And if you're troubled or suffering, what can be done to alleviate it? Bottom line. And, interestingly enough to me at least, it seems that in many cases, as there's a drawing near to the original true nature of what you are, there's a relatively proportional diminishment of suffering and anguish. That makes the human hopeful. Because if I was doing something like what we're doing here, and all that I was seeing was deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper anguish and suffering, no lightening up, no diminishment of the pain in the back when the bell rings. Did you notice the truth of cessation when the bell rings? I ring the bell, you move, you feel better. Wow. There's the third noble truth right there. I get it after every sitting almost. All I have to do is get enough pain going. I don't even have to try, actually. It just comes on its own. He rings the bell. I move. I feel better. Great. And I get hummus. In fact, the suffering and dissatisfaction, which is born from false identification, identifying with that which is not true nature, that which becomes fixed upon, there's the habit of fixing upon this, that's where the suffering comes from. And that fixing upon, that identifying with, occurs because of the power, the force, the liberating force of ignorance. Yes, it's true. Ignorance has the power to liberate. Consider this. How could there be any freedom if there wasn't suffering? Wouldn't know what to recognize, would you? When people say
ignorance is bliss, they're wrong. Ignorance is ignorance. Bliss is bliss. And identification with bliss is ignorance. Doesn't matter how nice it gets, how glowy, how big, how shiny, how nice it gets. Identification with those qualities, those states, is fueled by ignorance.
I'm beginning to actually talk a little bit here, you might note, about the causes and conditions for freedom. With each glimpse, even just a tiny little glimpse, just a glimpse of what you really are, there's a diminishment of false identification.
It happens spontaneously. That's why every instant of recognition, every instant of the aperture opening, every instant of clear seeing, even just the relative unfolding of these experiences, even just the clear seeing of that, there's a loosening of the habit born from ignorance of identifying with form.
What can be extremely powerful is to begin to see the causes and conditions in your own direct experience for unhappiness, unsatisfactoriness, and suffering. Because, like in all areas of life, when the causes and conditions are seen, when the causes and conditions are removed,
then the results that come from those causes and conditions automatically are transformed. There's a lot of mystery still in this, which is really, in my view, good stuff. Can't comprehend, can't figure it out, can't think through all the way. Like people who have full-blown HIV and AIDS through means like meditation, prayer, and a bunch of different things can come out of that and test negative. It's not supposed to happen. Christopher Reeve, Superman, you may remember, was going for movement in his body again in areas where he was not supposed to move, and it was starting to happen. Then he got a bad bed sore, he got an infection, and then he died. The body died. Did Superman die? The myth hasn't died. Who was Superman? That's a Zen koan. It's powerful to see the causes and conditions of suffering, because what it takes you into clearly and distinctly and certainly, with great certainty, without doubt, it takes you right into seeing the nature of ignorance. The nature of ignorance is the same nature as everything else. It comes and goes. So let's make it really simple, okay? Something comes up, some kind of decision, supposedly, is made, I don't want to experience this, okay? What's going on right there is ignorance, very simply, ignoring this. The reason why, for those of you who stayed around for Steve's movement, and even if you didn't, this will still be relatively relevant for you. At a certain point, the bell rang when we were doing the movement, or we were done, and we were lying down, and Steve said something like, this is what I heard, don't worry about that, ignore the bell. There's freedom to ignore, okay? So we can do this relaxation that we did. Freedom to ignore. Issue is, if you are sitting and partitioning the meditation and trying to ignore this and trying to ignore that and yet have this and have that, it's real different than ignoring the bell for a few minutes while you do relaxation. It's totally fine if something's too intense to take your attention away. That's part of freedom. But if you live that as a lifestyle, ignoring certain parts of the experience of living, what do you expect is going to happen? those areas of life are going to go on unconsciously, and eventually, in many cases, we can see this over and over, they're going to manifest in some form consciously. They're going to come to the surface. If you push it down, physics says it's going to want to come up. And remember this one, if you push it up, physics says it's going to want to come down. This is about going beyond down and up. It's the middle way. If the cause of suffering or unhappiness is seen, then automatically the condition of suffering is released. Now, second half of the game in this talk. The two most challenging areas in Buddha Dharma, and by the way, all the religious traditions, spiritual traditions, are the Dharma. This particular Dharma we're exploring is largely influenced by Buddha Dharma, teachings of the Buddha. The two most challenging areas to comprehend, to see clearly, in the teachings are selflessness and emptiness. And selflessness and emptiness are actually the same thing. These are the deepest core teachings of the Buddha. They're the core of the core. There's obviously styles of Buddhism where there's a lot of incense sticks and different kinds of rituals and different kinds of things that folks do. And sometimes it's a very wonderful feeling, but it's really more the surface. When you get inside the core teachings, okay, they're very pragmatic and direct. They have nothing to do with the religion, really. That's why when people say to me, "Are you a Buddhist?" I say, "No, I'm not. If I felt inclined to be one, I would, but I don't. I love the teachings of the Buddha. I experience myself on a good day as a human being. On a not so good day, I experience myself as a neurotic human being. And on a really difficult day, I wonder whether I'm verging on psychosis, which is a line between neurosis and psychosis." Okay? I'm kidding. The core, the deepest core of Buddha Dharma are the teachings on selflessness and emptiness. And it's interesting because not only are they the most difficult, but they're the most important. They are the most important because it's this appearance, keyword, it's this appearance and belief in a separate self or I that is causing and experiencing all the difficulties. It's the same self, it's the same I that is seeking a way out of the dilemma. And as we explored last night, this mirage of a self or I never finds its way out, and it has no real clarity about what it's going to get if it does. It doesn't know this, though. This I self does not know this. It's spellbound. It's spellbound in the difficulties, in the struggle, and it's spellbound in its efforts to get out. The idea or view that there is an I or a me to whom all these things are happening is the actual cause of suffering. And so what the brain mind sometimes does is it hears a sentence like what I just spoke, and it goes, "Oh, the view or idea that there's an I is the cause of suffering. I know what I'll do. I'll have the view that there is no I. I'll carry that one around." That's another self-I view. People sometimes wrongly imagine
that the release from the habit of living primarily in concepts, the biggest and most central of which is the concept of I or me, which extends itself into mine, my stick, my cushion, my car. And by the way, I won't say, just walk out here on Sunday and get in any car you want. Because during the nighttime when everybody was sleeping, I hypnotically suggested that you leave your keys in your car Saturday night. So when you go out there, the keys will be there. Just start it up, fire it up, and take off. Some of you would go, great, I got a Mercedes. Well, whatever. People sometimes wrongly imagine that the release from this habit of living in concepts, and it's a habit. It's a tenacious habit. It's okay, but it's a habit. That if this addiction to concepts goes away, I'm going to be cast into outer space without a lifeline. I'm just going to go flying off. Nothing could be further from the truth. What we're talking about here is the proper use of concepts to describe and differentiate things. For use in communication, but yet not be imprisoned in these concepts and ideas, lost in them, and seeing life through them. It's fine to say your room, your belongings, your cushion, your car, your house, your wife, your partner, your dog, you're this, you're that. It's fine to say I. Just recognize all of that will function amazingly more free when there's nobody there saying, it's mine. So, what is sitting here right now? Most people would say, I am sitting here right now. I, myself, am sitting here right now. Some people would get a little bit more sort of spiritual, and they would say, the spirit is sitting here right now. I am spirit. Now, if anybody says that to me, being the kind of character that you're seeing that I am, I say something like, what do you mean? Or I say, what's the experience of that? You know, I want to get down to, what are you talking about? There's a lot of ideations and projections and imaginations about what we really are that sometimes people carry around in here and try to be. Same young man I was talking about who has had an opening, he's had an awakening, only had some manic activity and couldn't handle his life in ways, had to go in the hospital. The guy with the Haldol shot I mentioned in the talk. Well, when he's manic, he says, I'm Brahman. I am the eternal. And then I say, am I also? And he says, no. And I say, well, that doesn't feel very good. You're Brahman and I'm not. See, that's not my sense of it. My sense is if you're Brahman, then I'm going to experience the Brahmanic plane with you when you say that to me, and that's not happening. Ideation, projection.
What's sitting here?
What's sitting here? What's sitting here is the five aggregates. This piece of the talk is so critical. It's so critical that the Buddha's teaching on the five aggregates, it's been called different things over the years, but as I learned it, it was called the All. The All, A-L-L. What is sitting here?
Body, feeling, mental formations, perception, and consciousness. These five aggregates cover all experience.
All experience,
or all dharmas, these dharmas, these experiences,
are made up of very subtle combinations of these groupings or aggregates.
Aggregate means grouping, collection.
This is what humans call the self.
Myself. Body, feeling, mental formation, perception, consciousness. This is myself. That's what it is experientially to humans, if they look experientially now.
In order for there to be a sense of self
in the experience of body, feeling, mental formation, perception, and consciousness, guess what? There needs to be a concept of an I or me who has a body, has a feeling, has a perception, has a mental activity, has a consciousness. These five aggregates comprise the totality of the experience.
However, there is no I or self. And what I mean by that is a permanent abiding entity that can ever be found upon investigation of these five aggregates. Can't be found.
And yet, it's assumed to be here.
This is amazing. It's assumed to be here.
Isn't that the strangest thing? Something that can't actually be found is assumed to be here. And if we're fortunate, this is going to get proven before the talk is over. Not just thought about. It's assumed that there's an I or a self in the body, in the feeling, in the thought, in the perception, in the consciousness.
But it can never be found.
And this mirage, this apparent thing, that nobody can actually... There's the I thought. I just saw the I thought. I saw the I thought. It's now been revealed to me. It was like a shooting star. The I self view that appears to arise with these aggregates, claims them as its own. And this is precisely why there is an appearance of separation. I am over here. You and everything else is over there. An I that can never be found, claiming ownership of one or more of these aggregates. And when there is no I or self-thought or self-view arising with these dharmas, they simply unfold freely and wonderfully without suffering. Without suffering. So, where does the suffering, dissatisfaction actually come from?
The rest of the talk will answer this question and explore what remains when there's an opening or a recognition of freedom beyond suffering. So, hold on to your hats. Sorry, you don't have hats. Hold on to your cushion. Nope, don't hold on to your cushion. Unbuckle from your cushion. Because there's nothing you can do about the recognition that might arise in relation to what's being said. Any effort to see will obscure the clear seeing. Any drowsiness or sleepiness will also possibly obscure. Does that mean it's simply roll the dice? No. Shakespeare's line captures the whole when he says, ripeness is all. Human beings wake up when they're ripe. Concept of body, as Steve pointed out, concept of body is different than direct experience. It's not just that the I self concept says this is an arm, this is a leg, this is a back, this is a chest, this is a head. It says this is my head, this is my arm, this is my leg, this is my chest, this is my body. So if you're willing, pause with me for just a moment. Some of you have your eyes closed. And just place your left hand in a sort of free spot where there's nothing obstructing its positioning. And then if you're willing and comfortable with this, just let your eyes close for a moment. So with the eyes closed, sitting still, focus on the left hand. And when that's relatively clear, allow a focus now into the left index finger. And then just move the finger a little bit. Move the left finger. Do it slowly and attentively. And notice what's going on there. What's going on there in that place that the mind calls finger? When you're ready, you can stop wiggling your finger and just let your eyes open again. What was going on there was sensations. Everybody got that? Sensations. Maybe there was a thought about those sensations, but when there's an awareness of the sensations, there is no finger, because finger is a concept. You probably wouldn't say, I am pressure, I am hardness, I am lightness, I am tingling, I am movement. But you might say, I am my finger, this is my finger. And equally true on the other side, there is no sensation called finger, is there? People say, I had a sensation in my finger, but there is no sensation called finger, there's no sensation called arm, there's no sensation called leg, and there's no sensation called body. These are concepts. And the more deeply it's realized that the body is ever only sensation, what this does is it frees the mind from the concept of body. And more important, it frees the mind from the concept of body as self, as I, as me. Let's hit another angle. If there was a self that owned things like the body-mind, then wouldn't it be able to logically have dominion over it? Isn't it clear? 3 days in, that the elements, the earth, the water, the fire, the air, the space, elements which are generating the sensations, are not being governed by anybody. They're governing themselves. And if there was a self that had free will, shouldn't it be able to have dominion over this and control it? Make it the way it wants? It's the same thing with thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and consciousness. They simply arise because of causes and conditions, and they are in truth empty of self or I. Now for this next piece, you can just sit as you are, no need to close the eyes, because we're all naturally contemplative. As thoughts arise in the light of meditative awareness, where is the self or I? Where is the self or I that is having the thought? Where is the self or I that's governing, owning, controlling the thinking? As feelings arise, use the body for that. As feelings arise in the light of meditative awareness, where is the self or I? Where is the self or I that's having a feeling? Can't be found. As perception arises, perception is what tells you you're in a room. The word room is a concept. The view that this is a room, this is a floor, this is a ceiling, that's a wall, is perception. As perception arises, that there's a voice speaking words, where is the self or I that's having the perception? Can't be found. As consciousness arises, and consciousness in the way that I'm speaking of it is simply the knowing faculty. It's a more subtle object than perception, more subtle object than feeling, more subtle than thought. As consciousness, knowing, simply knowing, bare knowing, is noticed. Notice how consciousness is invisible, intangible, lucid, empty, or open. And yet, body,
feeling, perception, thoughts are being known. Where is the self or I that's having consciousness? Notice how nothing that I'm talking about can be distinguished from other things that I'm talking about, meaning separated. But thoughts happen in the part of the body called the head. Feelings happen all over the body, including in the area called the head. Perception's a little trickier. Where does perception arise? Can somebody show me, where does perception that we're sitting in a room arise? Where is perception? The view that her leg is crossed. The word crossed, say yes, that leg is crossed. There's a view connected with the concept of leg crossed that's conditioned into the mind. There was a time when there was no word leg, there was no crossed leg, and there was no perception of crossed. We were very little when we had that. Emptiness. It's the same as selflessness. Emptiness in most everyone's daily language and thinking means the absence of an object. The empty glass means it's empty of water. The empty room means it's empty of objects like furniture or people. The empty boat is empty because there's no one in it. This is the ordinary, common, conditioned view about empty or emptiness. The meaning of emptiness in Dharma, there's an interesting word that's used. It's got different ways it's pronounced, different ways it's spelled. The one that I like the most is shunyata. Shunyata means emptiness in Dharma language. And it means precisely this: the absence of the idea or sense of an I or me. Notice, recognize shunyata right now. Notice this. Empty of the idea of self or me. When there is no idea, sense of I, then there is no mine, because mine comes out of I. Mine comes out of me. When there is no idea or sense of I, me, then there's no grasping or clinging to anything as mine. And then what's occurring is emptiness, shunyata. In this emptiness, all the objects of the world, so to speak, body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, unfold just the same, and yet none of them are being grasped as I or mine. The world of objects is also considered empty,
because the world of objects is empty of anything that could be identified as I or mine. Empty means open or free. There are two kinds of Dharma emptiness, shunyata. The first, all dharmas, all experience, all objects, including consciousness, are empty, empty of an abiding self or I. Therefore, all dharmas are selfless. There is no one who governs them, owns them, and there is no I or self that observes them. Awareness observes, but there is no I in awareness. Awareness is what sees this mirage of an I. You might see right now, the so-called I is also empty. The so-called I that can't be found is open. This is not about getting rid of a so-called I or self. This is totally about seeing clearly. The Buddha was asked, "What do you teach?" And like any great teacher, he had a way of saying a tremendous amount in few words. He responded, "All my teachings are about suffering and freedom from it." The freedom from suffering he's pointing at is what I described earlier in the retreat as freedom amidst. The freedom amidst suffering is when it's realized there is no I that's suffering. It's simply a play on words. The problem with the word from is that the mind takes a hold of the word freedom from, and it thinks that freedom is somewhere else. From. Very, very interesting the way these words sometimes work. To tie or to untie. How is suffering created in the mind, and how is freedom from suffering realized? Straight up. Suffering's created when any configuration of the five aggregates arise, that means experience, and a false idea of I or me arises and claims ownership. I am this, I am that, I have this, I have that, I don't have this. As soon as the I arises, there is clinging. There is a sense that this is me or this is mine. So really, the I itself, so to speak, is clinging. Now, watch. This becomes very operational. The nature of the I is clinging itself. When clinging ceases, the so-called I also ceases. Or when there is no I, there is no clinging. When there is no clinging, there's no holding, there's no grasping, there's no aversion, and therefore there's no suffering. There is emptiness, which is the same as openness, which is the same as freedom. Emptiness, openness, freedom are all the same. It would be impossible to withstand constant clinging. Although there are some human beings who try to perfect it. What is happening is that when the I is born, that means clinging arises. Whenever there is clinging, there is suffering.
And whenever that clinging falls away, there's freedom. The clinging, or so-called I, arises and passes many times a day. So all human beings, not just people who are meditators, so to speak, all human beings are experiencing momentary freedom every single day, in many cases not recognizing it, because that freedom that's there is open, empty space. It's very subtle, and therefore it's overlooked. It's nothing. And this nothing, Steve and I talk about this, this nothing that I'm pointing to, right, is simply the absence of I or me. It's just space. This I, this clinging, is being born and dying many times a day. It fades very, 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 way down and out in deep sleep. That's why deep sleep is registered to feel so good upon awakening. Because there's no clinging, or very little. Clinging can arise quite actively in dreams. Have you ever noticed? Waking state. Still, it's being born, dying, being born, dying, being born. Like everything else, it's arising, passing, arising, passing, arising, passing. This is what birth and rebirth means. This is not about birth of the body. This is about birth and rebirth and death of the sense of I or me. What I mean by that right now is clinging. The heart of cessation, the heart of the Third Noble Truth of the Buddha, is the falling away of clinging. And when that clinging falls, when that I, so-called I that's clinging, falls, that's the end of suffering, and that's the end of the sense of separation. So once again, pithy, direct teaching from the Buddha. In summary, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to. When this is realized, the whole teachings are realized. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to. This is the complete teaching. Makes total sense. If everything keeps changing, nothing lasts, then why cling to anything? However, this logic that I just spoke, in most cases, doesn't end clinging. And there's a very specific reason for this. The reason why, in many cases, this logic, these words, do not end clinging, is because of the ignoring of freedom itself. Ignorance of freedom. Clinging is the root of identification. Identifying with anything as I or mine is suffering. Self or I is the condition that arises when there is clinging. It is not wrong that it happens, but rather until it's realized that life functions quite fine, even more so than whatever fine you can imagine, when there's no I or mine in it. When there's an I or mine in it, then the ignorance is operating, more or less.
The way things really are is free, open, and empty of any self or I or mine. This is what true nature means. When life itself is realized as free and open and there's no I, self, or me in it, this is the original Buddha nature. This is the awakened nature. Now, precisely because of the first type of emptiness, which is the emptiness of all dharmas are empty, there is no self or I in any experiences. Precisely because of that first type or kind of emptiness, the second type of emptiness can be realized. And the second type of emptiness is the shunyata of what is here when there is freedom from the false idea of I or self. What is here? This is the realization of the unborn. Unborn in the sense that when there is no I or me being born, there is simply the open, empty space of freedom. It's absolutely fine and in fact necessary for the awakening that the body be born. Notice the common language. I was born June 7th, 1956. You bet it was 1956, June 7th. That's what they told me. It's on the certificate. I was born. Nobody says, the body was born on June 7th, 1956, but I wasn't. Look at that overlay. No investigation of the I, no discovery of emptiness. No wonder meditation's available to help us. I was born. What I? The realization of the unborn. Very simple. The unborn is the space, the openness, the empty, open, free space when there's no sense of I, me, or mine. That's it. Recognizing this is the recognition of true nature. And it's also where happiness and freedom reside. All the same. Happiness, freedom, openness, true nature. Different words for the same thing. This is not about something at the end of a long process. Years of meditation and special this's and that's. It's not something to get or attain. This is something to realize, recognize right now. One more from the Buddha. True nature of mind, the true nature of mind, is the inseparability of awareness and emptiness. Now, I hope you see all experience is empty, all experience is emptiness. The true nature of mind is the recognition, that's awareness, the recognition of emptiness. The actual true nature of awareness is emptiness. Awareness and experience are inseparable. Empty, open, free.
the famous Thai monk, Ajahn Buddhadasa, said it so well. He called what I'm speaking to truth discerning awareness. Truth discerning awareness is one with emptiness, one and the same. Where there is no I, me, or mine, there is no suffering. I'll conclude with this. Again, Manpala Sanbala, the book of great liberation. Your own mind is originally as pure and empty. Pure and empty as the sky. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Without beginning or end, your original wisdom has been shining forever like the sun. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Your original wisdom is as continuous and unstoppable as the current of a mighty river. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. When you realize that all phenomena are as unstable as the air, they lose their power to fascinate and bind you. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. All phenomena are your own ideas, self-conceived in the mind, like reflections in a mirror. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Arising spontaneously and free as the clouds in the sky, all phenomena fade away by themselves. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Again and again, look inside your own mind. When you look outward into the emptiness of space, you will find no place where the mind is shining. When you look into your own mind in search of the radiance, you will find nothing that shines. This self-originated, clear light is eternal and unborn. How strange and marvelous. Since it's unborn, it cannot die. How strange and marvelous. Although it is absolute reality, there is no one to perceive it. How strange and marvelous. Although it wanders in samsara, it is undefiled by evil. How strange and marvelous. Although it sees the Buddha, it is unattached to good. How strange and marvelous. Although it is possessed by all beings, it is not recognized by them. How strange and marvelous. Although the clear light of reality shines inside their own mind, most people look for it outside. How strange and marvelous. These teachings are immeasurably deep and contain all wisdom, although they are to be contemplated in a variety of ways. There are no two such things as contemplation and contemplator. When fully contemplated, these teachings merge with the seeker, although when sought, the seeker cannot be found. How strange and marvelous. The uncreated,
self-radiant wisdom of your original mind. Actionless, immaculate, transcendent over acceptance and rejection, is itself the perfect practice. Can we sit for a moment or two in the emptiness?